President Carter gave you in the October meeting. Still, there was a dispute between Dr. Brzezinski and Secretary Vance as to whether the draft communique that you were to table should have a date on top. You will remember that in your presentation, you did not refer to any target date of normalization. We never established the date. But
running from July on.
That's right.
Oh, that's true.
But in the tabling of the communique was the first time that any date was mentioned, and it was in the communique, and it was dated January 1st.
Right.
Now, I'll tell you how the January 1st date
came about. That date of one, the one was a surprise to me.
That's right. Well, here's how that came about. We presented a draft communique to the president and then said you have a choice as to whether to put a date on the top. And Dr. Brzezinski puts down January 15. And I wondered where Zbig got the 15th. I didn't understand, perhaps, from as I recall. And Cy Vance argued strongly against not putting any date down. He wanted no date whatsoever. And so we submitted to him this draft, and then with the option, January 15 or nothing. Brzezinski recommends, or Vance recommends nothing, and he just scratched out the 15 and put down January 1, typical Jimmy Carter. But did Secretary Vance know at that time of the import of your conversation with the president that he wanted to buy about January 1 or 15? And if so, why did he argue against putting any date down?
It was certainly implicit, if not explicit, because the whole notion surrounding it was that it had to be done after the elections.
Mm-hmm.
Preferably before a new Congress would take over, that possibly would have to begin almost from square one to consider
right.
the problems. I have no particular memory of any date discussion in my last session with Vance and Holbrook.
Well, in any case, that did have the January 1 deadline. And to me, that was very significant because it really was the first time that
I brought everything into sharp focus.
That's right.
What had been sort of floating images suddenly took on an air of reality.
That's right.
And the next day, the third.
Well, what was Huang Hua's reaction?
He was playing his impassive role in that session, as I remember it. He was not like he had been on the 3rd of October in New York, but he was not effusive or, this means a new turn of events and that we are on the last lap. There was none of that. Being very diplomatic. Then the next day, the Schlesinger party came back from the north and had their meeting with Li Xian Nian. And I think it was in that meeting that some reference was made to negotiations and the ambassador, because this happened, as I think I've observed before, on more than one occasion, when a Chinese high official would refer to negotiations, and I'd come up with the standard, we're always negotiating, which seemed to satisfy everybody. And the next day, Secretary of Agriculture Berglund came. And on that same day. He came at 2 in the afternoon, and at 4 o'clock, Schlesinger had his meeting with Hua Guofeng. So I think you're right. Deng Xiaoping probably was not only not in Peking, but not in the country. And then at 6 o'clock, we had a reception at the residence for the two cabinet delegations. And that Berglund was there first, and Schlesinger didn't show up for an hour and a half. And this was just the opposite of the reception we'd had for the technicians just a few days before.
Schlesinger didn't want to be there with Berglund.
It had been cleared with both of them, obviously. We'd like to have a reception, and we, for convenience sake, would like to do it together. And both parties had said yes, but there may have been a good reason why he was held up anyway. Instead of an hour, it dragged on for 3 hours, not because of any merry momentum, but because we had to keep... I think we had Chinese there too, and so it got to be very awkward. And then on the 6th of November, while they're still both there, I see I hosted a luncheon for a Citibank delegation headed by Walter Wriston. So, again, the high-level business people were still continuing. But the Berglund sessions with the agricultural people were very, very interesting, and the Chinese almost acting as though we had normalization in their not anxiety, but their great desire for further exchanges and learning and the recognition that in this area they too had things to offer, and that they made. That they made very clear. I remember sitting on one subcommittee when a representative of a Chinese institution identified as the World Economic Institute, which I'd never heard of before that, and not since.
Oh, yeah, it's one of the institutes in the Academy of Social Sciences.
Is it? Berglund had made the inquiry of the Chinese ministry people, are you interested in discussions and exchanges on agricultural statistical gathering? Yes, they were very much interested in that, and this is what this subcommittee was set up for. And so I went into the meeting out of curiosity. And this individual is saying how terrible their statistical methods are, that it, during the Cultural Revolution, been completely destroyed, and that the UN had presented to them some time before that their estimates of Chinese crops for 1977. And he said, I am ashamed to say that we don't know whether those numbers are right or wrong. And there was a representative there of the State Planning Commission. He intervened to say, that doesn't mean we don't know what we're doing. But this was November 1978, and he painted a picture, which is, I think, fairly accurate of their whole statistical gathering, the personnel scattered, destroyed and not yet
right.
put back together. Now Berglund did not see any high level people. He saw Li Qiang, Minister of Foreign Trade. That's all he saw. And that's because Bob said, I'm seeing the people that I need to talk to. What difference does it make if I see the highest level people? And since the Chinese didn't offer, he didn't press. He didn't indicate he didn't want to. But
he, by the way, among the many people who dealt with Chinese, I was very impressed by Bob Berglund. He is a superb individual and of high integrity, competence,
right.
Low-key, businesslike. He really made a commitment on the part of the Department of Agriculture to the China connection. He did a great deal for the relationship.
I noticed that he had a press conference on November the 8th, and I also noticed that after his farewell banquet, we had a tour of the Great Hall. Because when he came out, this is also typical of Bob Berglund, he said, this is a wonderful building. Can't I see it? And so this, of course, was 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. They turned on all the lights. And as a matter of fact, it was the first time I'd seen all of the Great Hall. And then I see this little item, curiosity, on the 10th of November. Earlier than that, the Norwegian ambassador had sent me a communication. Would I be available for dinner? Sharon and I be available for dinner that night. They'd like to have a dinner in our honor, and we had said yes. So at 7:30 on the night of Friday, November 10, we go to the Norwegian embassy. It so happened that they had not been able to get enough acceptances and the dinner had been canceled, but they had not informed me. The Andes were home alone. So they invited us in to have a drink, and stayed, maybe half an hour. But I get a call from the foreign ministry while I'm there. And because they wanted to know, could I be available for a meeting the next morning with the vice premier for an American group? What American group? Well, you go to room number so-and-so in the Peking Hotel, and there, you go there at 9:30, and then you'll meet the group, and then you wait there, and we will let you know whom you will see and where you will see him. Curiosity. They apparently knew exactly where I was. Then afterwards, we came out, and our driver had disappeared because he had thought we were there for dinner. We had to go find him. But the group, the next morning at 9:30, I go to the appointed room in the Peking Hotel. The door is standing open, and I knock on the door and walk in. It's the Merrill Lynch group headed by Regan. he looks startled. He said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I was called by the foreign ministry last night and told to be here, that we were going to, all of us going to see a vice premier." Oh, he said, "That's why we were all told to be in this room and wait." And so we then got the word, and at 10:15 we met.
This is the old style, isn't it?
We met with Li Xianyan. It used to happen occasionally, towards the end, almost never. But at that time, almost every time, it was that kind of... Then in mid-November, and this really created problems for me in a subtle kind of way, Ed Muskie brought a delegation. Of course, I'd always been very close to Ed Muskie. had Leon Billings. Did you ever meet Leon Billings?
No, I heard about this delegation.
But Leon Billings was Ed's chief aide. He went with him to the State Department. Leon Billings used to sometimes fight tooth and toenail with Ed Muskie, but he would lay down his life for that man. It was that kind of relationship. And Leon was always full of ideas. He was a political scientist. He was from Montana. And he was full of ideas about what we should do about the Chinese relationship. And kept pursuing me with getting into areas which got a little difficult in view of what was going on. And, you know, I couldn't indicate in any way to Senator Muskie that I had the strong feeling it was on the final track and so on. They were still, I think, out of the country when normalization was, maybe not, because this is mid-November, but I sent an immediate message to him after the event in a letter to tell him how badly I felt at not being able to level with me, because he had always been so very gracious and good with me. Even during the whole business we had over auto emissions controls, when he and I, when I was trying to achieve things with which he was not in agreement, we continued that close relationship. But I noticed Muskie also met with Li Xian Nian. And at that same time, we had a delegation from the American Association of... was there an American Association of Sciences?
Yes. AAAS. Something else, but...
And this was headed by... No. Dodario, the former congressman, was its chairman. But present congressman, Mike McCormick, was state of Washington, I think, who was a very intelligent, man, was also
American Association for the Advancement of Science.
Right, that's
AAA,
right. And then...
Let's stop and talk about Li Xian Nian for a minute, because you saw him many times in this context of visits. Did you get a feel for him at all?
Li Xian Nian, yes. As I think I've mentioned, he was the first high Chinese official who received me when I first was there in July 77. He was very warm and gracious and kind. He went out of his way to make me feel welcome at a time when that was certainly not the official line, and at a time when politically things were still very much in flux in China. I always enjoyed going to meetings with Vice Premier Li, because he was very witty, had a good sense of humor, and he was really the most open of all those.
Expansive personality.
Expansive, exactly, an expansive personality.
Kind of a Chinese warlord type.
And he enjoyed the meetings, and he made it very clear that he enjoyed the meetings. My last meeting with him as a vice premier was during the week, I think, in September of 79, when the National People's Congress was meeting, and it was already well known that he was resigning as a vice premier. And I remember on the way out, bidding goodbye to the delegation. I asked him, told him how much I had enjoyed all the meetings, and I would hope that I could still have the opportunity to meet with him when he was no longer a vice premier, but still a vice chairman. And, he said yes, that would be possible, and that because of my fond memories of him, I had him on the list of those whom I wanted to see for the last time before I left China. And we had that time I reviewed some of these things and started by telling him the reason, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons that I had asked was because he had been so warm and friendly to me in my first visit. And he was the one, of course, who made the March 79 speech that finally got acknowledged. 20 million unemployed, 100 million hungry Chinese, many grave social problems that we had to address. And always seemed to give indication that he would be one in the Chinese leadership who would insist on facing reality. That's the impression I got.
Do you think that he was as anti-Soviet as Deng?
If you can judge by the rhetoric, I would say no.
Yeah, that's my impression. Deng, one thing that just really struck me as I reconstruct the conversation in my mind, Deng was always talking about Soviet expansionism and their plot in the East and the plot in the West aimed at the Straits of Malacca. All of it. Li Shanyan, I can't recall. I only met him once, but I recall a lot of the things that you sent back. I don't think he had that same unremitting hostility, fear, concern with the Soviet Union.
If the question came up, he'd give like answers, but he was much, even then, he was much lighter about it.
And how about Taiwan?
Same thing.
Same thing.
He'd be much more likely to say, I would judge that, well, still stick to the 5, 10, 20, 100 years. Now, that doesn't mean that he'd be saying that mm-hmm. in sessions that he's having today.
Right.
Say warlord. Why do you say that?
Oh, I don't know. He just meets my image of a little bit like Huang Jun, too, of a person who enjoys authority, enjoys commanding people. Chinese warlords were not ignorant of the problems of China, by the way. There's not, they're not, and not without. But a person who is, and let me put it, why I say a warlord is not someone who you would say of whom he was a revolutionary or a Marxist-Leninist. You know, I think he stumbled into communism and into the communist movement and saw it as the best route for improving the lot of his people. But that the way to improve the lot of their people was to unify them first through military force. And that he really is a military, that's what I mean by a warlord. He's a person who understands military might, but as to whether he understands Marxism, Leninism, strike me as someone to whom ideology meant a great deal.
They had the little mannerism of speech, and finished, and they said, while it was being translated. I remember one group, asked what problems were they having with their population control plans. The biggest problem with population control in China is every Chinese grandmother wants a grandson. Which is probably a truer answer than most of the answers
right.
we got to those questions.
Yeah, well, that's another part of it. By saying my image of a warlord, maybe that's not the best term, but a very earthy person.
Yes.
Very, very practical and earthy.
Right. And how are you?
I got to go to a lunch.
Okay.